Welcome to the 3 Men in a Retrospectives look at the Incredible Hulk series.
How long has it been since you felt real pain?
Part of Percolated Media's full Marvel podcast series.
It's a wonderful plan, isn't it?
Join Matt.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Adam.
You look like a massive nerd, even around other scientists.
And Garrett.
The third was some giant, if I can believe the descriptions.
As they look at various film iterations of the Incredible Hulk character.
I hate them.
Wait, I just got here. Who do we hate?
From Bill Bixby to Eric Bana.
You could always close out the world when you wanted to.
The three co-hosts will review 4 Hulk TV movies, as well as the 2003 Ang Lee-directed film.
No one can take that kind of punishment.
So prepare to Hulk yourselves out, podcast listeners. The Percolated Media Incredible Hulk Retrospective begins now.
In each of us, there lives a kind of beast made of rage. Years ago, I used science to study this beast, to bring him out of me. I used gamma radiation to release him, but I used too much.
The Trial of the Incredible Hulk aired on May 7th, 1989. Budget was unknown, and because most of the people you can ask are either long gone or had nothing to do with the finances. And this was directed, surprisingly, by Bill Bixby. Bixby pulling a Leonard Nimoy, going from in front of the camera as one of the prominent characters, if not the prominent character, to behind the director's chair. Well, for every Leonard Nimoy, there's also a William Shatner who thought he could pull it off. Where does this fall in the directorial spectrum? Boys, unlike the last one, which was really kind of all over the place, of the three, this is the only one I had seen prior to this retrospective.
The commercials leading up to this, you know, you're going to see the trial of the Incredible Hulk. And you know what I assumed right off the bat? And I want to get this disappointment out of the way. I assumed this was going to be the trial of the woman who died in the pilot. Spoiler alert, that's not what we get. But I was kind of led to believe that that's what was going to happen here, as well as getting a fucking trial. But
Adam, you know, you're not much of a Thor guy, as you documented last show. And you're also kind of in the same boat about Hulk. Does the inclusion of Daredevil, when we put this on the schedule, did that give you any, like, tickle your proverbial fancy at all? Or were you just like, oh God, I can't wait to see how they butcher this?
I had no idea that this movie was another co-starring production until I watched a trailer after last week's film. And I gotta say, it got me kind of giddy. I was excited that we got the Man Without Fear in this one. I didn't know how they would do it. I didn't know if it would be any good, but I was blown away when it was just like, you know, next movie, and it was like such and such as Matt Murdock, and I'm like, whoa, slow down. So yeah, for the first time maybe in these, it got me excited. I popped to see what they would do with Double D here.
Well, Daredevil's inclusion was actually calculated. So let's get into the making behind the scenes, because these three movies that we're talking about, Returns, Trial, and Death, they were part of a three-film agreement to do Hulk movies that potentially could spin off into other television shows. Because New World, and as we talked about last week's show, the Hulk had been off air for multiple years, and it never really got a sensible conclusion. And Marvel was looking to get as many characters as they could as possible. And the original plan that fell to the wayside, because there was a TV Doctor Strange movie from the 70s that we're not going to review because it doesn't really quite fit the criteria, and also it's borderline unwatchable, for one thing. There was the late 70s Captain America TV movie. And around the same time, you had the Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man show, which did not have the same success that the Incredible Hulk did. So when it came time to do these movies and bring Hulk back, it made all the logical sense of the world to do these guest characters, because team-ups are nothing new. You know, crossovers are part of the DNA of comics, certainly Marvel, because so many share the same geographical location. In this movie, it's New York by way of Vancouver. We'll talk about that once we get into the movie. But yeah, bringing Daredevil in kind of made all the sense of the world.
Yeah, totally calculated. And you mentioned the direction of Bill Bixby. He had directed a couple episodes of the TV series, and he would go on. He would do a few episodes of Blossom. You know, he would direct a few episodes of Blossom. He would stick around directing for quite a number of years before his passing. But at this point, Kenneth Johnson's, like, off the project. Like, he's not even a blip.
Yeah, he has nothing to do with any of these TV movies.
No, he's a blip on the radar screen at this point. But to talk about the inclusion of Daredevil, I mean, you look at this movie, and it's obviously a setup for a pilot, right, Matt? I mean, that's really where they're
clearly
going
from. Well, that was the plan. When they talked to Rex Smith, who is the actor who plays Daredevil in this, the plan was to springboard this into a TV show. Because this really is also, it's as much a backdoor pilot for that as much as it is a continuation of the Hulk show. If anything, and maybe this is because Bixby's behind the camera, Daredevil kind of takes center stage in a lot of ways.
Yes.
The plot is built around Banner, but he's really just the inciting incident to bring in Daredevil and another character that we'll talk about. And it's worth noting, because we got to talk about the history of these characters. This was the first live-action debut of Daredevil. People always think it's the Ben Affleck movie, which came out 15 years after this. But it's not coincidence, when you look at the history of the character, that the late 80s were the time to look at bringing Daredevil to the screen in any way. Because while he had debuted post-Fantastic Four, you know, Hulk, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Daredevil's in that list as far as characters that Stan Lee just created because they were trying to get as many characters as possible. But the character that originated shifted dramatically. In a lot of ways, you know, he is kind of, in a lot of ways, the Batman of Marvel. And his character's changes and the comic changes mirror Batman right down to Frank Miller himself, which is a good place to begin. Because Daredevil had been around for 20 years, and he was a well-known character. I would say he was above characters like the Punisher as far as popularity, but the character initiated, if you've seen the original comics, he had yellow was the predominant color on his costume. A lot of the other things, you had writers like Marv Wolfman, you had Roger McKenzie do the character, who was really the first one in the late 70s who talked about doing Daredevil as a darker character. He was the character that created Ben Urich, who was kind of the Jack McGee, in a lot of ways, of Daredevil. But Frank Miller himself, who I have plenty of negative things to say about, both as an artist, as a director, and as a person in some respects, he was hired by Denny O'Neill, who, Adam, you know from Batman. So it's funny that you have both Frank Miller and Denny O'Neill taking a Marvel character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, this is a line of questioning I was going to say for Ben Affleck when we get to those movies, and I'll probably ask again. But for this movie, I got to ask, so Daredevil's been around since the 60s, and you said around 20 years, so 70s, 60s?
No, he debuted in 64.
Wow, okay, so he'd been around, okay, wow. I had no idea. I thought he was a relatively new character when this movie debuted. Okay.
Yeah, this is not sort of trying to capitalize on a brand new character. They were really going after Frank Miller's new take, where when he started writing for Daredevil, the title was about to be canceled. And look, that's something that happens with a lot of Marvel characters when you look throughout their history. I mean, look at the Hulk himself. He's been canceled more times than a lot of politicians. But he worked with McKenzie, but Miller eventually became the sole writer, and he also became the main artist, which not everyone... When you think of Marvel, a lot of times it's a split. You have Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. You have Chris Claremont and John Byrne. But he was the one who really took Daredevil, the things that you associate nowadays with the character, between this, the movie, the Marvel show with Charlie Cox, because not only did he make it darker, it was much more hard-boiled film noir elements, but he drew Matt Murdock to resemble Robert Redford.
Oh, interesting.
Who, when you think about it, certainly could have played the role if this was a feature film. And in fact, you talk about giving something credibility, that would have been a huge get if that ever came out. But Miller also changed the tone of the character. One of the things that he did was he made Matt's father abusive and a drunk, which is really part of the reason he becomes a lawyer. And the big thing he did that he gets a lot of credit for was he made Kingpin Daredevil's primary villain, kind of took him away from exclusively Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And he's really the person responsible for linking those two characters, which has continued now for over 40 years.
Yeah, so many people identify him with Daredevil now, but he was Spider-Man's nemesis really until Miller kind of went and rebooted and reshaped and rebirthed Matt Murdock. So, yeah, it's You can say a lot of things about Miller, and God knows I do, but he is a story, and not as an editor, but somebody who kind of had the controls of an editor. He did some major, major changes.
The other big change he's known for was he really took Daredevil into the full martial arts territory. Mm. Where in the original runs, he was a gymnast, you know, he was certainly acrobatic, but as far as like the ninja aspect, because Frank Miller's the one who came up with Elektra, who's been a prominent character, he's the one who introduced Stick, the hand. I mean, if you're a fan of the Ninja Turtles, you really have Frank Miller to thank, because they were basically a knock on everything Miller was doing with the character.
Why, they're the Foot Clan.
Yep, they go from the hand to the foot. But the other thing, as far as timing goes, Miller did a comic called Born Again, which was ironically pretty close in time to The Dark Knight Returns. And it's still to this day probably the most popular Daredevil story, so much so that everyone's borrowed from it. The third season of Daredevil kind of borrows a lot from it, but it's not been straightly adapted. And there's only little is brought into this movie we're going to talk about beyond just the key aspects of the character, which is also interesting because we would not, as I said, get the Ben Affleck movie for another 15 years after this, because the TV show never came to pass. And do you know the reason why? I found this fascinating.
No. I mean, the fact that we got a Flash TV series and a Daredevil TV series does kind of boggle me.
Well, that's exactly why.
Oh, is that why? Okay.
Rex Smith's contract was bought out because DC did not want any competition because of the Flash. They wanted the Flash to be the only superhero show on at the time.
Interesting.
Which is why the pilot was never bought, and they literally bought him out. And ironically, you know, the Flash, it was popular, but it wasn't the Hulk. Certainly didn't get the ironically, the treadmill of length.
It was in my house. What the Hulk was in Garrett's house, the Flash was in my house.
You know, I have a soft spot for the Flash show, but I don't think it's great.
It's cheese.
You know, because a lot of things that I didn't like about it, because I've seen The Flash, I watched that as a kid. I'm like, most of the early shows, he doesn't fight villains. He fights like motorcycle gangs for most of it. And it wasn't until it got popular where they're like, okay, let's have him start fighting, you know, more of the rogues gallery. But getting back, that's kind of the overview of Daredevil as a character up to this point. And we'll certainly revisit it when we get to the Ben Affleck movie proper in 2003. But as I said, this was part of, you know, the three film television deal to get both the Hulk back and to springboard more characters. Other ones that were considered, and these never came to pass, they wanted She-Hulk in one of these.
Interesting.
Which makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
And they also wanted Iron Man at some point. So Iron Man had been trying for that basically as long as they had been trying to get Spider-Man on the big screen. But the problem, like a lot of things, would have been very hard to do Iron Man on television at the time.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, God, you can't do Iron Man without computer graphics, really.
And a lot of people say you can't do Iron Man now in hindsight without Robert Downey Jr. Like, could you imagine anyone else in that role?
No.
Yes. Yes.
Well, who then, if you say yes, who would you put in there? Michael J. Fox?
Back in that time, I think you would have a lot of people. It would be somebody like that. But sorry, I have a hard time saying that nobody can ever play a role but one person. And not to preview stuff we're going to fight about in 3 years, but I think that's Marvel's current problem.
Yeah, certainly. But I also think when you have someone like Robert Downey Jr. or Christopher Reeve, it's very hard to get them out of the zeitgeist of culture.
Yeah. No, when the first thing that you do is such a massive global success, that's when it's hard to switch.
And it also helps when you're the first, like, and the biggest. Well, you know, you had Max Fleischer with Superman, and you had George Reeves.
George Reeves.
Christopher Reeve was, like, the cinematic Superman. And that's why a lot of people don't know about this Daredevil, because they think Ben Affleck is, because it was the first, like, big movie, they think he's the first actor.
Oh, can I not get to that movie?
Oh, I can. Oh, man. Because up to this point, of all the characters we've done, I am probably the biggest. Daredevil's probably my favorite Marvel character as far as singular heroes. And ironically, for me, my love of the character came from, or my first love came from the Spider-Man animated series where he guested. Mm-hmm. And that one, Peter Parker's framed for like corporate espionage, and Matt Murdock and Daredevil have to help him out. Ironically, they both go after Kingpin, which makes all the sense in the world. But that TV show also did his origin. So that also was trying to, it's just so funny compared to this, that was also trying to get a Daredevil animated show down the pipeline, and much like this, it never came to pass.
Hmm.
Speaking of coming to pass, one thing that really hurt this, at least as far as pop culture, came out a month before Tim Burton's Batman would change everything.
Yep, a month before Batman. And man, can you feel them trying to chase that tail in this film?
Well, another thing they can chase, we talk about history. This is the first debut of Daredevil in live action. This has the very first Stan Lee cameo.
Yes.
Which that scene we'll get into, which, by the way, I got to be up front. This title is one of the biggest instances of false advertising I can think of.
It's unbelievable. And I remember there was an interview with, I think it was the writer, maybe it was Bixby himself, and they said the trial of the Incredible Hulk is actually a metaphor for the trials that David Banner has to go through. Well, that's what you got everybody to tune in for. Like, it's so funny. LA Law, I think, had already started by that point. You were really trying to capitalize on something to get the ratings. And yeah, the trial consists of a dream sequence.
Yeah, it's
don't make it your poster and your preview.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. Yeah, when I logged this in Letterboxd, like, the picture associated with it is him toppling that fucking jury box.
Yeah, and you see that the poster is him in the courthouse with the white contact lenses, Lou Ferrigno standing behind him. And when you have a character like Daredevil, you expect, and that's why you bring in Daredevil.
Yes.
To do an actual courtroom defense. Because, to your point, what if Jack McGee finally caught him or got the tip to get him arrested and you have him having to answer for all the stuff he's done, including, you know, the death of his wife, girlfriend? What was their relationship again?
They were partners that were going on to being lovers.
Okay. See, that's how unmemorable I that is.
That was 3 weeks ago, man.
The workers with benefits.
Well, yeah. They were friends with benefits.
There you go.
Are we going to be friendly to this discussion? Because I don't think any of us were especially friendly to the last movie beyond just camp enjoyment. We'll find out. And we open with in the same way that episodic television did, kind of a recap of bringing you up to speed with where this character is.
Yeah, this was kind of jarring for me because it had spent about 10 years. Every week, you would have that piano theme and the guys talking over as we're seeing the evolution of Hulk and how he became the Hulk and how he's dealing with it. Here, we're getting a recap from Bixby himself. Now, I don't know if they just couldn't find that footage or what, but yeah, this was kind of different. I gotta say, I kind of dug this.
I just found it a weird way to start. Like, what? I guess if I was waiting for the movie and I knew it was, or TV episode, and it was, but I'm just like, this is just jumping right into, I'm like, who, what, why? I'm okay. You want to make sure your audience is going to stay on that couch and not move. So I guess it's effective that way.
Well, the odd thing is I could see doing this if this was the first movie, sort of like a here's what you need to remember. But by doing this, it kind of makes the last movie feel really obsolete and almost like you don't need to watch it to get to this one. Now, look, none of these three movies are like interconnected. Like, it's not a trilogy in the way we think of it. But like I said, this kind of, it almost makes it feel and add a layer of redundancy to the last movie.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, nothing was really interconnected. From episode to episode, you didn't have storylines that were connected, really. And so it just kind of felt like an episode of the TV show, really. We're just kind of moving on to the next thing. The only connective tissue is he's trying to find a cure. That's it.
Which is the driving force of this recap. Mm-hmm. And we see that in the same way that the show opens with him in a new town, living in anonymity. At first, I thought he was in prison at the start, because we see him digging a hole with a bunch of other people, and apparently high school bullies still work in blue collar workforce, because this guy just pushes him into the puddle for no reason. He knocks him off the bridge. I'm like, clearly we missed something, because this guy's just being a dick.
And yeah, I had no idea why they were fighting. What something's missing,
because he's a small guy on the schoolyard. That's why. Matt has it right. He's just a big fucking bully. And I gotta say, you know, at this point the TV show, this is, like you mentioned, Matt, it was a number of years after the TV show had gone off the air. We are 12 years removed from the debut of the TV show, the pilot. You're telling me that this guy can't keep this under control still at this point? Like, he's holding up this axe, like he's going to throw it. He doesn't know whether he's going to hit him with it or not. And this is what pushes him to get away. It's just like, you're just running away from the problem. And I get that's the point of the TV show, but my God, you talk about redundancy.
Yeah, and much like the TV show, we see that he's living somewhere, but he pays the rent lady his deposit back, and he's told, I'm going to go into the big city. And I love how this woman openly tells him, oh yeah, whatever city, we're going to pretend it's New York, but it's clearly Canada.
Okay.
It's like crime corrupted. It's basically saying, like, you must never go there, Simba.
Okay, yeah, this was a big thing with me. All she says is, you're headed to the city. A lot of people don't come out of there alive. What city is this? I think we're led to believe this is New York, especially considering Batman was coming out a month later. I'm assuming it's New York, but they never really tell us. So New York, Philadelphia, who the fuck knows? All we know it as is the city.
Yeah, but I do think anybody, I mean, Marvel's always been New York, so that's how I took it. But also, I think back in this time frame, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, we grew up in an area where the suburbs are fine. The cities, you did not go to the cities by yourself. I don't care if it was San Francisco, Oakland, New York, Chicago.
Well, they were all synonymous with collapsing infrastructure, higher crime rates, like everything that RoboCop was satirizing was happening across the country. So this is really just a stand-in for any metropolitan area, but it's clearly supposed to be New York because that is the hub for basically 90% of the Marvel roster. Now, not all of them live in the city. You know, the X-Men have a mansion in like Westchester, which is not, you know, in Manhattan or New York City, as we know. But if you're Banner, why are you going to the big city when you're still trying to stay anonymous? It's a lot harder. I mean, it's easier to blend in, but you're entering an area where you can turn into the Hulk, as we find out, just by getting on the subway train.
Yes.
And not for the reasons that happened in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, one of the other things, I think this is both a net positive and a net negative. I like that Bixby, he's not hiding his age. Like, he's a middle-aged guy at this point, you know, pushing 50. But it's, to your point, Garrett, really, it's been 12 years of this shit and you haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, and it runs into problems that, I get it, they weren't thinking about this in 1989. But when he hulks out, Hulk doesn't have a beard. And I know in the comics that I had, if David Banner had a beard, the Hulk had a beard. So, like, they don't even keep that continuity. Like, you couldn't paste a beard on Ferrigno for those scenes. It creates all sorts of problems. But to your point, Matt, to the aide, it is a bit of an issue at this point. I get that Bixby wanted to keep this going, but if you're going to step behind the camera, stay behind the camera and direct Daredevil. I have some big issues with the age in this movie. Although, doesn't Hulk, I stopped reading them at a certain point. Doesn't Hulk, don't they have, like, old Hulk comics?
Oh God!
I'm sure. Yeah. Oh God!
Yeah, they got like an old man Hulk, almost like the Planet Hulk, and
okay.
When you get into like old man Wolverine or old man Logan, you have an older Hulk with a beard and such. But I may be the one. Like, it not only did it not bother me, I think Bill Bixby is grown as an actor massively by the time we get to this film, and I think he is tremendously better.
You know what else is better? It's the fact that they have a real writer here. They have a writer. His name is George DePego. He would go on to write not great films, but he did The Forgotten with Julianne Moore. He did Message in a Bottle. He also wrote Phenomenon with John Travolta. He is an actual screenwriter. And before, they had TV writer who would put these together. So I think that helps as well. And Adam, I think you're right. I do think, I'm not criticizing his performance. I'm just saying that his appearance and demeanor is different.
I get, yeah. And you were the Hulk guy. To me, I'm, I guess I've always wanted, because I'm not. And even when we get to the later movies, I'm still not a Hulk guy. So yeah, I mean, just differences there. But yeah, good on Bixby, because it's, like I said, I think we can all agree he's so much better now.
Oh yeah, I think this is the most I've liked him up to this point, and quite frankly, it's not close. And to your point, Garrett, about the facial hair, that was a whole thing with when Red Hulk first debuted. And I think the only reason they didn't give him the mustache was to not give away that it was General Ross. But yeah, Hulk and facial hair, that's like when Jerry Seinfeld and George Costanza are arguing about Aquaman's proximity to water and whether or not that kills him. The anal stuff you have to talk about with comics, which... Speaking of anal, he goes to the big, what we think is New York. He rents a room, still staying incognito, and we're introduced to our first introduction to Matt Murdock is him waking up in his bed. And it's not until, unless you know this character, like, pardon the pun, if you go into this blind, you don't realize that he's blind until he pulls out the cane,
yeah.
Gets downstairs, because he does the thing where the box falls in the closet and he just kind of instinctively bats it away. So I like that they're... It's a surprise that he's blind, because Daredevil wasn't well known to the general populace. And I gotta say, this Rex Smith guy, he's pretty damn good. I would argue he's too good for this movie.
I think it's a dang good introduction to the character, because I think you get everything that you need to understand. He was a working actor. He already had a show by this point. He is really good in this. And I think Daredevil as a whole, like, it's, you could see that DC was scared enough that they had to buy this away from Marvel or find a way to, you know, sabotage it. But pretty damn good Daredevil and pretty damn good Matt Murdock. He plays both sides of that, especially for this time frame, really well.
He has a bland charisma, but it works for this character. I'm not going to sit here and say he's bad because I don't really have a big association with the character as you guys do. But for this movie, for how this movie is structured, I do think he works.
Now, the problem I have is the same one with like Reeve and Jackman, all those instances. To me, Charlie Cox is so perfect that I do kind of have to judge everyone based on a scale. But I think this guy is, preview this now, I like him more than Ben Affleck when we get to that. But also, I will say, like, most of the, as far as being a respectable take on Daredevil, this is pretty damn accurate. The only thing they don't include is his Catholic upbringing, which, as we talked about in the Punisher shows, that is a huge part of his character. And that's not here at all. But as far as the broad strokes, I mean, I'm shocked. There's a scene in the in his house where he gives his full origin, and it's pretty damn faithful.
Okay, you mentioned the Punisher. I got to talk about this right now. So we do have a cast member associated with Punisher in this movie. It's the gal who plays Krista, who I'm assuming is Daredevil's girlfriend. I don't know. They're leading it on like it is. And this character...
Yeah, so this is weird because she's basically written to be... She's basically Karen Page and Foggy Nelson if they were merged into one character and it was a woman.
And why they wouldn't take this character and make her the focal point of what happens in this movie boggles my mind, because that would be the thing to do, right? You would have somebody who has an emotional connection to Daredevil to be the captured damsel in distress. But no, they go a completely different route with somebody who we never met before, don't see afterward. Very big mistake, I think, with this movie.
I actually think it works because it reflects Banner trying to stay anonymous. And Matt Murdock, his whole thing is like helping people, takes cases pro bono, which he does with Banner in this. It would have made it feel kind of contrived if it was his girlfriend getting kidnapped or his partner. That would have felt like, oh, I'm doing this because I have a connection. But I like that he does it because it's, in his mind, the right thing to do. And it puts Banner in an interesting perspective because he has no emotional connection to this woman. But this movie is also kind of about him reclaiming his humanity and realizing that he can't stay siloed anymore. Well, for another year until they kill him off. But spoiler alert, yeah. At least that title's more faithful than this one. So we see him go to his office. He's got, to your point, his girlfriend. I mean, she's not even called Karen Page. Because it's normally Nelson and Murdock. Like, they're normally joint attorneys that share a practice. I think the reason why she wasn't Karen Page is because of, they wanted to keep this very PG. There's violence here, but there's no blood. There's no, like, no swearing. And she's a drug addict.
Wow.
Which is a big aspect. So I could see why they wanted to steer clear of that.
Is that a Frank Miller addition?
Oh, yeah. What Frank Miller treats Karen Page like he treats women. You can put it as simple as that. Okay. But I also do think that they wanted to keep some things. If Daredevil did get his own show, you keep some of those and bring them along for the ride.
Yeah. I mean, the ending of this movie is clearly setting up. They had plans for bringing all these people back. And speaking of plans, we get an orchestrated jewel heist in this diamond store where, you know, these guys clearly have choreographed this, and they're being overseen by their architect, Wilson Fisk, who is never called the Kingpin in this at all. And played by Sala himself, yes. John Rhys-Davies.
Yes.
And holy crap. Indy, my friend. Oh my, I cannot believe. Because I'm looking, I'm going, is that? No. And I paused it just to look up IMDb. And I got a smile on my face. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's late 80s look. I mean, this is Kingpin by way of Miami Vice, but this is Kingpin. I mean, this is pretty, you know, he's got the suit, he's got the mannerism, like, this is pretty cool.
All right, if I can get a little nerdy here, would it have been that much of a pain to put a bald cap on him?
Yeah, because he was working with Spielberg right after this. Yes.
Yeah, but the Kingpin is bald. He's never, I don't think there's ever been a comic frame where he's had hair. Yeah. But that's me being very nitpicky. I like that Kingpin, you know, rather than making him like a mob boss, his whole thing is like a movie director.
Yes.
Which I think that's a really cool motif. And it made me think, God, Orson Welles would have been a great pick for this if he was still alive.
It almost feels like he's channeling that.
It's just so funny because we went from Scream to this, and we just had a movie in the third movie in that series that dealt with a movie director who was angry and was trying to get back at people. And we had the same thing here. It's just kind of funny.
Yeah, but I can also see why they didn't call him Kingpin, because he's not dealing with, like, low-end mafia or that kind of stuff. He doesn't have, like, in the comics, he has a public persona as this, oftentimes, like, philanthropist. He's been mayor. You know, he has this upstanding perspective, but behind the scenes, he's literally the Kingpin of, in some comics, all of the crime in New York City. Like, his tentacles would make Blofeld and Spectre look very small. So I can see why they don't call him that, because I don't think it would have fit, because the movie's not really preoccupied with that. I like his performance. I like the motif with, like, because he talks about, like, you know, are you an actress? He's got all the camera. He's got all the televisions. He's wearing those ridiculous visor sunglasses, yes. Which made me think, are they going to say he's blind to kind of make him and Daredevil parallels even more?
I thought that was the character in the comic. Does the character in the comic have sunglasses like that?
Well, there was a run where he got shot in the eye and he was temporarily blind.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks, Echo.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, they do that in the TV show, but it doesn't stick. But yeah, I mean, as far as getting like look, Jeremy Stevens is not 6'8 and 500 pounds like he's drawn in the comics most of the time. But as far as like the voice helps, you know, he's got a very loud, boisterous way that he delivers his lines. I like that. If you notice in all of the scenes when he's talking to people, there's like a platform. So he's literally standing over them, talking down to his Wesley stand-in, even though the character's not called Wesley. He talks down to all the other mobsters and he's shot from low angles to make him look taller. So for again, you know, this is kind of the first big appearance for this character as well. It's certainly, they get more right with these than I thought they would. This didn't come off to me as like, oh, you have to include these characters. This feels like they did, but they took the time to do the research.
Yeah, and last week we just had a himbo kind of roam in out of nowhere. You know, this guy who loved David Banner so much, he wanted to see him at work. That kind of just turned into what it turned into. And you're right, that did kind of feel like a mandate. Here, we have reasons why these characters are here, and I like this better. I was just say that right out the gate.
Well, I think this is a more respectable adaptation than, like, if I was a Thor fan, I'd probably be a little bit more upset, because it's clear they didn't. It's either they didn't do their research or they weren't preoccupied with it. This, considering, I mean, they left the hard edge stuffed out, but there's a lot more here that they kept intact than I was expecting. Certainly from a Hulk show, because you would have the excuse to, like, make him drastically different or toned down to not stand out. But like I said, between him and Fisk, they kind of upstage everybody. But we see he's just orchestrating a diamond heist with the car. And then we cut to Banner on the subway train where, because this is New York, like, there's just scumbag rapists just walking around. They're harassing this woman. I thought we talked about Predator 2 a couple months ago.
Yeah, I was just thinking, and Adam just mentioned this in Scream 6. How many of these movies are going to watch where there's a fucking something going on a train, which Adam works in for a living? Going back to the diamond heist, I do have to say that Beverly Hills Cop 2 had come out, what, 2 years before this? So I think they were kind of playing off that without the slickness of Tony Scott's direction, obviously. They are playing off things that are coming up and things that had happened a couple years before.
Yeah, and you know, this is, you got to show some kind of organized crime,
yeah,
not just, you know, muggings on the street. So I think this works. And I like that Banner completely, he only helps when he is physically threatened. He has no desire, she says, like, sit next to me. Although I find it a little ridiculous that he gets thrown across the room and that triggers him turning into the Hulk. So if he falls down his stairs, does he Hulk out just out of frustration?
Well, he hulked out over a fucking flat tire in the pilot. So, I mean, yeah. And you could tell this is Bixby's age also coming in, because they are speeding this film up when that happens. And yeah, kind of ridiculous the way he becomes Hulk here.
Yeah, this one, it reminded me of two things. One, I just recently reread Daredevil Born Again, because they just put it out in the Marvel's, I think they call it the premiere format, which is it's a pocket-sized edition, so great freaking value. But there's a scene on that where Daredevil, as Matt Murdock, is in a subway, and he does not do anything to the people getting attacked until he's assaulted.
Interesting.
And it's amazing, just because the time frame, and if I didn't just read that, I never would have got it, but I think they're literally pulling from their own sources, which is kind of cool. But yeah, this is a budget Hulk transformation right here.
This is a budget Hulk.
So much so they literally put a bunch of benches he changes behind the seat.
That's really going to come into play later, but we're seeing the foot expand, and we're not even seeing it as good as when they did it in Big Trouble in Little China. This looks like claymation that they're doing here. It's kind of ridiculous. We do see a shirt tear and lose Lou. He's bigger than ever here, I think. I think he's huge when he finally comes out, but yeah, the transformations in this movie suck.
And I hate this coconut melon haircut they give him.
Yeah, yeah. Coconut melon.
But he does Hulk out, literally, and he takes these two guys out, but in the skirmish, old man gets shot as the subway is craning down, just wrong place, wrong time. So this part's also weird, because they're still trying to make the Hulk scary. But it's also comedic when the guy gets thrown on the platform and like a bowling ball just knocks people over. So I find a little bit of inconsistency with those. But I like that they kept the thing of he just wakes up and doesn't know what's happened, but he does get arrested. So now I'm thinking, oh my God, we're actually going to get a trial.
Of course. And Hulk is also, he's greener than ever here. Like, it looks like they got the paint kind of right. Although a lot of inconsistencies with it, you know, the more skin showing in this one than ever. I think it's just because of the lighter color green that we have more skin showing when we have Lou here. But yeah, I do like he runs on the platform and then we cut to him being arrested. Again, yeah, we're going to lead up to a trial here, right? Right? Yeah.
Well, I think the reason they experimented with the color, so they were talking about She-Hulk, but they were going to make her yellow.
Oh, interesting.
Because remember, this is the same production team initially that wanted the Hulk to be red. So they also wanted to do it to make her distinctive from the Hulk, which has always been the problem with She-Hulk, where it's like, yeah, she's the Hulk, but just a woman. Unlike every instance of the Hulk, she can fully speak, like she's fully has her mental faculties and stuff. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, the yellow thing would have been fascinating. Maybe that's why they were experimenting with the color grading, just to see if like a brighter one would hold up. But the woman who he inadvertently saved, we find out that he is being charged with attacking her. And we'll find out that she was basically, now it's a little murky, she was put up to do this later on after the fact under the threat of being killed.
Yeah, she becomes the centerpiece of this, and that is not a good idea.
Yeah, she is literally a damsel in distress that needs to be rescued from her castle.
Yeah, and Fisk is, like, every other scene, Fisk is like, what about the woman? What about the woman? Like, it's the center of the movie. And when you're talking about a trial, it doesn't play.
Yeah, it's a little weird that she becomes, if anything, you'd think she'd be on the podium getting examined with this. Matt agrees to take his case. He meets him in prison. And I think these two actually have pretty good chemistry together, where he's asking him, like, you know, with the handshake, he tells him, like, my hand's here.
Yeah, that was good.
Which pays off later on, because, you know, that's the thing with Daredevil that's always been weird for, like, the uninitiated is, how do you handle other people in normal life when because he's not wearing the... This is another thing I appreciate. They didn't give him like ridiculous contact lenses that are like white, I guess, because they do that for the Hulk. He's not wearing the glasses that are dark, which Daredevil, Matt Murdock wears a lot, wears out in public. So
I got to ask you guys, I got to ask something real quick, because I'm not as averse in Daredevil comics as you guys are. Is he pretty much like Peter Parker, except with the red in that comic? Because I find this character, he has the one-liners in this. It kind of came off as Peter Parker-ish to me.
So he's always had a good sense of humor, and he's learned how to like joke at himself with where he is in life. So the weird thing is that he's legally blind, but anytime like he uses this cane also, not just to keep up appearances, but like the force of that creates a radar sense. So he can see like temporarily. So he knows where he's going. That's how we can fight so well, but he is fully blind. And they do like the radar thing where there's scenes where it's like green neon to kind of show like his POV. I was thinking of Predator for some reason.
Yeah. And I like that parallelism because it goes with the Hulk, you know, with the Hulk being green, you know, they're trying different things here, which I respected.
He is blind, but all of his other senses are just cranked up to 11, which is how he can fight and all that. And the one thing I don't like, he just went to a gym and that's how he knows how to fight so well.
Yeah.
I find that a little ridiculous, because like in the comics he's taken in by Stick. He extensively gets trained in every form of martial arts, almost like a Batman level of martial arts.
You'd have to pay other actors if he did that, Matt.
In this he just hits the weight room and the balance beam, and he suddenly knows how to fight like Bruce Lee. He tells him that, you know, Ellie's attackers work for Fisk and you got to do the right thing. Dave is completely uncooperative, but he tells him that the right thing to do is to help her. Okay, so this is my first WTF moment. So Fisk orders her to be killed because she knows too much. And we cut to her in the hospital about to be injected by a henchwoman that is basically straight out of a Bond movie.
Yeah.
And we get the first appearance of Daredevil, where he is dressed in black. So that at the time he was still wearing, he started out in yellow, then he switched to like a darker red. But this like black ninja suit, that was retroactive. Frank Miller added that after in like 93.
But you know why they did it? We had Batman coming up the next month.
And it also saves you some like costume fitting. True. And it's a lot easier to do this. But I'm fine with this because I've never loved in any version when they try to do the full Daredevil suit. I don't like it in the Ben Affleck movie because he wears so much leather that he shouldn't be able to hide because it makes so much sound. They do it thematically in the Netflix show because he has to fight Fisk, so he has to get armor. But even that kind of looks clunky. I'm fine with this ninja outfit. I actually like it quite a bit. I mean, it's very basic. It's very simplistic. It's very streamlined. But for this, it works just fine.
I didn't think we were going to be getting the black suit, so this surprised me. I think it looks pretty damn cool. And I usually don't like a lot of Daredevil's outfits other than the Affleck movie. I think the rest of them are just not what I want. I don't think they do a good job with it in the Netflix series. We'll fight about that later. But I dug the suit. I thought it was a ballsy move to go this way.
I mean, speaking of ballsy, I mean, this fight seems pretty clunky because he's fighting a woman, but he just moves out of the way and she gets electrocuted to death, which this made me laugh. Like, this is something I would have seen in like a Naked Gun movie.
Absolutely.
Around this time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like that this is kind of the first thing of seeing Daredevil in action. He kind of beats her pretty easily. The electrical circuit did all the hard work. She calls Matt and tells him, look, I'll come clean if you get protection for me and her parents, because Fisk's men are going to go after her. But before Matt can actually meet with her, she gets abducted by Fisk. And Fisk also puts the hit on Banner in prison, because we cut to him in this cell and the guy beneath him.
Okay.
This is ridiculously
so stupid.
Happenstance be damned.
Yeah, he gets a shim from somebody. I don't know where he gets it from, but Banner just happens to raise up right when he puts it right through the mattress. This was silly. Later on, he's going to be sleeping and having nightmares, and he had the perfect opportunity to do it then, but no, he doesn't do it. This is just silly.
I mean, this put the shank in Shawshank.
We'll be talking about that pretty soon.
He goes to see, like, the police chief, who is basically their version of Commissioner Gordon because he's the one good cop.
Yeah. Did you recognize him, Matt?
Yeah. I mean, it's the guy from, I mean, he's been a lot of things, but I know him from Days of Our Lives.
Days of Our Lives and Jaws 2. We just reviewed him last year. He was the guy going after Brody, pretty much taking the mayor's spot. Yeah, he was right next to the mayor when Brody came in to argue that that was the shark. You know, he was the one who was also supposed to be hitting on his wife. That guy.
Oh, okay. He puts him in a private hallway and tells him, look, I'll give you one chance to come clean and tell me, like, what's going on. Because he's kind of also like the stand-in for Commissioner Corden and Jack McGee. Like, this is the closest they get to investigating or any sort of cross-examination.
Yeah, I like this, though, because every hero needs an ally, right? I like the fact that, yeah, Daredevil is a loner, but this is the guy who pushed him to become who he is. So I do like that bit of symmetry there.
Okay, put a pin in that, because I hate, there's something with him that happens that I hate.
Okay.
So as soon as you said that, I kind of winced up, because we're going to have a fight about that shortly. But yeah, he's basically Commissioner Gordon, except this guy's more competent than Pat Hingle ever was in those movies. But it makes you wonder, okay, if the city is this corrupt and you are the chief, how has nobody killed you yet? It's a hard thing for me to disbelieve. But Banner doesn't rat him out or say anything. He sticks to his guns, and he doesn't tell about the Hulk, because there's eyewitnesses saying a big green thing, but that's all they can come up with. Meanwhile, we cut to Fisk interrogating Ellie, and he asks her if she's an actress, and she talks about how she's a teacher, and oh my God, is this, yeah. Her acting in this is just so over the top.
Yeah, it's bad.
I mean, my God, like, I saw this in All My Children, basically, speaking of soap operas. But when we cut back to Banner, he goes up to his bathroom in the cell, and we get the titular trial, or they should have called this the hallucination of the Incredible Hulk, because he's in a courtroom and everything's heightened. You know, Murdoch's yelling at him, the prosecutors yelling at him, the judge is yelling at him, and he gets so worked up that he hulks out, and you see Stan Lee clear as day sitting in the juror's box.
Yeah,
his first big cameo.
Bottom right, yeah, or bottom left, very first cameo. And you have to say too, Matt, this comes after Murdoch is like, so why don't you want to be on the stand? Why don't you be on the stand? And then it literally fades into people yelling at him, what is wrong? What happened? What happened? And yeah, this is when he starts hulking out, and my God, you talk about fucking foreplay without payoff. This is crap.
I was so bad at this. Just because I think I'm finally getting a trial. This is called the trial. We've seen an image of the trial. And then for this to be bull, and then it doesn't pay off later. We don't get a trial. So somebody thought it was cute because Matt Murdock's a freaking lawyer, but this, goddamn, Princess Jasmine couldn't pull a rug out from under me so fast as this.
I will say this, though. I do like the scene. I like him picking up that jury box, and I love the story of Stan Lee where he said he wanted to do this, but Bixby wouldn't let him do it because he thought it was too dangerous, and Stan Lee was like, I could jump out of a fucking box. But yeah, this just doesn't pay off. I do like he punches people, which Kenneth Johnson was way against. He never wanted Hulk to punch people, but we have Ferrigno hitting people during this. I like the scene. I just hate the result of it.
It's also a very awkward transition to get to this.
Yes.
Because it's very clearly not in the reality. Mm-hmm. It's clearly a dream sequence. But it's also, like I said, it's what you want this to be, what the movie was sold on in many respects. And it's not integral to the story, as we find out. It's just an excuse to put something showy in your advertising.
And title.
Yeah. Between this and Joker 2, I never want to see a courtroom in a superhero movie ever again. And we have a Daredevil movie to talk about later on. I think there's a couple in that movie. But this triggers the Hulk. So he dreams about hulking out, and he hulks out, and this is how he breaks out of prison.
Yeah, okay. So after this Hulk out scene, which ends up not being a Hulk out scene, it's a dream sequence, we cut to Banner at the mirror, and he has another Hulk out, but all we see it is from the perspective of the guy who tried killing him 20 minutes before. We don't see Lou do any of the shit that we're going to see the result of. We see bars being broken, we see the wall being broken, but we don't see Lou doing any of this. This is when the budget of the film just shows its seams, because obviously they needed to save money. And the primal reason I loved Hulk as a kid was you get to see him break stuff. We don't even see that. We see the result here.
It's also a way it's like, okay, how do we get him out of prison? Well, we can't come up with like him getting assaulted by prisoners or like a fight breaks out on the rec yard. No, it's he has a dream about hulking out, and that's how he gets out of prison. Mm-hmm. I find that also kind of a bit of a cheat. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted a better explanation.
Definitely.
Especially because him in prison, where it's a highly stressful environment, we also don't do a lot with that. Like, he's in prison for 20 minutes. Murdock, though, does some investigating because he's trying to find out where this David guy came from. So he calls his clerk and he tells him to find the apartment that Banner is staying at. And David initially suspects that Daredevil, because he shows up in his apartment. He also does the Batman thing of he's just there without making any noise. You get around with that by saying, oh, he trained under ninjas. But apparently if you just go to the YMCA, you can figure out how to do it. Tells him to stand trial, and we get the cliched thing. Now, it works for this movie. But Daredevil openly blows his cover by revealing his face.
Yes.
Which, God, this I hate this trope anytime it's done, because if you do this, then why the fuck do secret identities play such an integral part?
Was it cliched at this point, though?
No, not yet. But this is also more like he intentionally does it. It's not like Superman where, oh, my glasses got knocked over.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Everybody in those movies has brains made of Teflon because they can't see through a pair of glasses. But this is also before, I mean, we'll see this in a month. This is not as bad as Vicki Vale being let into the Batcave or Michael Keaton ripping his mask off at the end of Returns, but thematically it works because they both have secrets to protect, and that's like their mutual respect. So you need this to kind of get buy-in from Banner. It's just a pet peeve of mine with superheroes. But he tells him that basically I'm gonna help you out, but there's this guy named Fisk who's basically behind everything. Now, they never... It's clear he's dealt with Fisk before, but unlike a lot of versions, it's made apparent by its lack of knowledge that Fisk has really nothing to do with like his origin, which I appreciate because that's one of the things I don't like in the 03 movie. You know, it's too much Joker killing Batman's parents. But we'll get into that eventually.
Yeah.
But they go back to his house, Daredevil. This is where we get the origin, where they touch on his dad being a boxer. They talk about how he wasn't blind from birth, which is what most people think. He was blinded when he was a teenager because he tried to save someone from getting run over.
I got to ask you guys, how accurate is this?
It's pretty damn accurate. Like I said, the only thing that's not really included is his Catholicism being that is as important to his character as like Batman's no kill rule.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause he doesn't not kill, but two things. Matt's a slut massively. Matt Murdock fucks his way through the Marvel universe, like nonstop, but his guilt, his Catholicism, the other half of his parentage, I'm not going to spoil anything for people that haven't read some things, even though it's been decades, all that stuff matters, and it ties into the Catholic Church specifically. So when you get those gorgeous images of him, you know, draped across the top of the cathedral, there's a deeper meaning behind it.
Well, it's also important to his character because his dad being a boxer. Back in the day, you know, because Murdoch is Irish Catholic, boxing was sort of the defining aspect of, like, American Catholic manhood around that time. So it was very intentional they made his dad a boxer. There's a line they mentioned he, like, wouldn't go along, which is, in most instances, his father refused to throw a fight, which is why he was killed. So that's touched on here, but yeah, it's not just the boxing, but his Catholic identity, you know, that's a huge aspect of his character. It's also kind of the, because it was the 80s, that's very Reaganism.
Oh, yeah.
In a lot of ways. But yeah, it's very hard to do a Daredevil piece where that's not part of his character at all. Now this gets away with it because they don't have the time to delve into that. And B, it's not that important. His psychology is very fascinating because he has to bend the rules a lot because of what his proceedings are. There's a lot of comics where he'll go to confession and just talk to a priest. It's just riveting to listen to him talk because he has a lot that he struggles with. But unlike Batman, he's usually not as mopey. Now, some writers take it too far. But to Adam's point, yeah, he gets around a lot.
And also, for those that haven't, and Garrett, you'll get a kick out of this. We'll tie it in someday. That is the same container of radioactive material that falls into the sewer that the turtles then get exposed to.
Oh, that's funny.
It is the same vial. Yep.
Wow.
But he tells him his whole backstory, basically. Outside of, like, if he had a cross on his wall, they would have explained that. But luckily, he asked about the certificate of heroism, which is, you know, him saving that guy. But he tells him, you know, stay out of it for all intents and purposes, because if you Hulk out, I kind of can't really help you. Because it's also clear, like, he still can't control the Hulk, which I have problems with, because I'm just annoyed by that around this point. But Daredevil goes to, in keeping with Fisk being the director, they go to literally an abandoned movie theater. Like, I have expected Mysterio to show up.
I expected Roger Corman to show up. Like, it's so weird that they go to a theater for the climactic scenes of this movie.
Well, one of.
One of, yeah.
This is one of two. But Daredevil shows up. She's literally, this is actually some clever writing, and I have to give them credit. Fisk doesn't know he's blind. So, of course, she would be set up like live bait.
Yes.
Yep.
And I love, like, he does the lights, camera, action thing. And he also doesn't know that. So Daredevil is not, it's not one of those things where he has, like, a weakness per se outside of, you know, women in general. You'd call that his kryptonite. But you can fuck with him by using sound, which is why they use, like, all the speakers and stuff to disorient him, because that throws off his radar sense.
See, so, I thought of 2008 Hulk does a similar thing where they do this sound to distract him or whatnot. I thought of that when I was watching this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you hit him enough, like, he won't be able to see as well, because who would? But they do that in the 03 movie when he fights him in the church at the end.
Oh, yeah.
He hits the bell multiple times, and that throws him off. But Daredevil gets his ass kicked, and Banner has to save the day by hulking out. And again, they do it because he's behind the door.
Yes. The fuck?
This game ridiculous.
Yes.
He might as well go into a phone booth and then it cuts. But Banner does arrive as the Hulk. He saves him. And Matt realizes it's Banner because he does the face tracing thing, which at least they weren't in the rain like in the fucking 03 movie. See, it makes me want to vomit every time. He's like imprinting.
Well, I mean, short of him having to tell him who he is, how else are you going to do this?
And this also re-triggers, you know, because Banner hasn't been practicing medicine for a long time. So I like that him, like, rehabilitating Murdoch is kind of his way to realize, oh, I can help people again by doing, you know, sort of like Doctor Strange with what I set out to do initially.
Yeah, like I mentioned, that they have a real screenwriter here, and I do find him connecting dots that they never thought about connecting before. So, yeah, I respected that as well. I'm way more into this than I thought I would be, actually.
And me too, especially for someone who didn't care for the pilot or the last movie. Like, this is not perfect, and I think there's some shortcuts they take because it's only 90 minutes. I'm sure if this was 2 hours, they could have fleshed some more things out. But I actually think putting Banner more as the supporting character rather than the lead, which I think works better for the Hulk just in general,
yeah,
is a welcome addition. And it bucks the trend from the show that was exclusively about him to the last movie where Thor's there, but it's still a Hulk story. Yep. This one, they're pretty, it's almost 60-40 Daredevil. He tells him to spread a cover story about his injuries by just being falling downstairs. And he's literally got a freaking bat phone in his living room where the Gordon stand-in can just call him.
That's what I thought of.
This is stupid. I'm sorry.
Speaking of flaws,
I was like, oh my God, this is, Bruce Wayne should sue his ass. Adam West should sue his ass. But that did not make me cringe as much as the flashback where the cop is talking to a bunch of reporters. And he said, it's going to take a real Daredevil to clean up this city. And that to me was almost as bad as the freaking skull shirt and the Thomas Jane Punisher. I hate when these movies have to contrive ways to explain why these characters have their names. At least in most iterations, he gets the name from his father's ring nickname.
See, this is why I love the fact that I'm doing these shows with you guys, because James, you mentioned the skull shirt in Punisher. You were really up in arms about that. I needed to know, what is it about these characters that gets people up in arms, like what you did with the skull shirt? So I respect that I'm on here and I'm talking with you guys about this, because I had no idea about the rage bait that happens when it comes to these shows.
Commissioner, is there a 6 foot tall Daredevil in New York City?
And he has the easiest way to explain it. It was his father's ring name, Jack the Devil Murdoch, in a lot of cases. And, of course, the guy who's a Catholic is going to use a personification of the devil to fight crime. That's all you need. And he doesn't even come up with it himself. He stole it from someone else. So my nitpicking brain just, I almost hulked out internally, because I thought that was kind of ridiculous. But I like that, you know, Banner's now like rebuilt his confidence, and he talks about how they bond over radiation, because he's like, you don't know much about gamma radiation restoring eyesight, do you? He's like, no, but I've had my fill of radiation exposure, which is also a thing most people don't think of. These are two characters who, you know, get their gifts from radioactive waste.
Yeah, and I saw the Ben Affleck theatrical film when it was first released, so I didn't remember any of this. So this is pretty accurate, huh? That he also is a result of radiation?
Yeah, the toxic waste got in his eyes. Like, that's, again, outside of the Catholic upbringing, they hit all the key aspects.
Okay.
Or at least the ones that, like, were most important for something that's not his. I'm sure if the TV show got picked up, they would have brought in the Catholicism and given him an actual love interest. And who knows, maybe they would have done Elektra. I don't 100% know, but she was also popular around this time. I also love this. Fisk gets all the mob bosses together, and he literally shows them the footage of Daredevil getting killed.
Yes.
to convince them. It's like he's meeting with producers to sell his movie. Like, they really run with this director motif to the point where I was thinking, like, if it wasn't Orson Welles, like, they should have gotten, like, an actual, like, director to play this part. But the problem is, you got to find someone with size, which a lot of them, like, Richard Attenborough didn't have that. Orson Welles did, but he was dead at this point. But this just made me laugh. But the climax of this movie, if you want more Hulk, tough shit, because the last minutes of this movie, the Hulk doesn't do a goddamn thing.
Fucking enraging that we don't get a Hulk out in the finale of this film.
But they do the assault. It's basically the ending of the 89 Punisher, ironically, where they have to top of the tower to fight the main boss. And I also found this lazy, that his right-hand man has been, like, helping her out because, in his words, Fisk always forgives him, which makes Fisk look incredibly stupid.
Big time.
Yeah, so I think the climax for this has a lot of holes, because as a Hulk fan, you're not going to be pleased because Daredevil does all the hard work. The hardest thing Banner does is touch an elevator button to go up. But I also love how they, like, Daredevil is known to quip like Spider-Man, not to that degree, but I love when he breaks through the TV and he goes, intermission.
Yes.
and he fights all the guys, but this, straight out of RoboCop, we get stop motion with this airplane that Fisk used to get away.
The only thing that was missing was
I'll get you next time gadget.
That we have Fisk Tower, essentially, which is awesome. That we have what Charlie Cox is known for. We get a hallway fight with Daredevil, which is freaking awesome. And then we get such a comic booky finish that we have this airship on the roof.
Oh, I love this.
Oh my God. You might as well pull this off a spinner rack.
Yeah, I thought a kick ass when I saw this. You know, we just reviewed that last year. That's what my mind flashed to. Just amazing. And it looks like a Star Wars land speeder with one of the brake lights out, you know, as it flies away. Just fun stuff.
Yeah, it's fun, but it's also like, if you're a Daredevil fan, you'll be disappointed because him and Fisk don't have, like, a fight.
Yeah, that's true, but they were saving it. They thought this was going to be a pilot.
Yeah, they clearly had plans. It's just kind of like, it's a little anticlimactic.
I agree.
Especially for something that doesn't have a trial, I would at least want a schoolyard fight, but we don't even get that.
Yeah.
But Fisk flees, and David and Matt have a parting thing where David says, like, you know, I'm going to go, and there's this lab, and so this is clearly set up for the last movie, where he talks about, you know, there's a new lab that's opening up a radiology department. It's almost like he literally refines himself, and he also realizes that he can coexist with people, because I was like, this is like the first genuine friend he's made in God knows how long. So I like how this ends, because, you know, Matt sticks around to protect his city. Banner gets to walk off on the highway, which holy crap, that winding road, I thought he was going to get hit because he's walking right in the middle of the street. I thought this was going to end with him. I thought we were getting the death a week early.
He's walking like he's the blind man.
Yeah, he should have borrowed the cane. But, you know, it's a 90-minute movie, but that's the trial of the Incredible Hulk, although I want to put that title in quotes.
Yeah. Really, don't lead people on.
But that does it. I mean, it's short and sweet, but are we going to be sweet to this movie? Certainly in comparison to the last couple. Adam, what do you give this on a scale of 1 to 10?
Going into this, I was worried after the return of the Incredible Hulk and after the pilot, because it, as I said, I was not a big fan of those movies. I'm not a big fan of the Hulk. So it's, you know, you kind of get what you come in for. But this thing surprisingly surprised me. I found myself completely enamored almost right off the bat. And I do think still putting the Hulk almost as a supporting character is kind of the best use of him. And that's just me. That's just someone who's not, you know, the biggest Hulk fan. But I thought this was going to be a trial for me to get through. Instead, this has been the best one of these so far. Bixby, acting-wise, is at his best, and it's not even close. Getting in, you know, Rex Smith as Matt Murdock, he does a really good job. He kind of captures the man without fear here. I like him. And John Rhys Davies as Fisk is inspired casting for that time. Now, think about it. Indiana Jones, sorry, scratch that. I'm embarrassed. I'm going to stab myself later. Raiders of the Lost Ark, that movie alone gave us three different villains in the Marvel Universe, between Red Hulk, between Doc Ock, and between Wilson Fisk. So, brava. Hulk fans, I could see being upset with this, because at the end of the day, what this is a backdoor pilot for Daredevil. And maybe that's why I like this so much more than the others. Not that it disparages anything to do with the Hulk, not that it does anything against that character, but it does sideline him and makes him a sidekick in his own show. But Bixby directs well, he acts well, and this one is kind of the most accessible. It feels the most Marvel Universe-y in its execution and completionism, and it's the first one that at the end of the day, and when the credits ran, I had a smile on my face. So in the universe that this exists, it's a 7. It's the one that I enjoyed the most. And if you're going to watch one of these TV movies, I would absolutely suggest putting on Trial of the Incredible Hulk. Just be aware, there's no trial.
No, and the jury has returned with their verdicts, so we're doing a better job with the legal proceedings than this fucking movie. But Garrett, are you going to be as kind, or are you going to be acting as our prosecutor?
Well, you know what? I'm the fan, so yeah, I am going to be as kind. And I, you know, it's funny, because you can pretty much copy-paste a lot of what Adam said into what my final review is going to be, because I had bad memories of this. I remember being disappointed when I watched this with my dad, and my dad was like, that wasn't really good, was it? And I said, no, Dad, I don't think it was. But in watching it, I liked what the writer and Bixby were doing here. I liked the parallelism between the Hulk and Daredevil. I liked just the outlandishness that we get with Kingpin, John Rhys Davies here, who obviously had a week to kill. So he came in, he sat down, he put some sunglasses on, he slicked his hair back. And when Bixby said roll, he did his scenes and left to go to Spielberg's set. There's something really funny about that. But in putting my full focus on this and realizing, no, there's not going to be a trial. We are talking about the trials of the Incredible Hulk. I dug this. Now, there are mistakes, obviously. I still stand by that you should have put Krista in the center of this, the woman who was in The Punisher as well. Another one who just kind of walked off another set to do this. In that way, there are issues. I think the beginning is a little slow. I didn't like Banner almost getting into it with some fucking guy who could have been off the Superman 2 bar set and rolled into this one. But once it got going, and once we get Hulk and Daredevil, quote-unquote, teaming up, I really enjoyed the proceedings, despite the fact that we don't get a Hulk out at the end, which, goddamn. If this was the final film, I would have been so angry. This wasn't a rating success, and I think that's a bummer, because I do think it's the best one that we've reviewed so far. So, yeah, I have the same score written down as Adam. I have a 7. It's a perfect way to kind of proceed with this character. We're 12 years in. Bill Bixby's getting a little long in the tooth. It was time to kill him off. We'll talk about that next week. But for the trial, yeah, 7 out of 10. Good time.
Well, I'm going to be the 12th angry man on this podcast and dissent from the consensus opinion. Not to say I didn't like this, but I'm just not 100% in favor with this depiction of the Hulk. I know it's got its value and its legacy and brand recognition. Certainly it's responsible for Marvel getting on the map as far as like popularity in live action. So they're already starting from a place I don't like. I do think this is the best up to this point. But I still feel like we're kind of handcuffed to a Hulk I don't 100% like. Now, they do more with him than I was expecting. And unlike the other ones, there's actual like thematic context and comparing and contrasting him and Daredevil. I think that's handled much better than I thought it would be. But I can't lie and said like I love this or think it's great art or anything like that. So I'm going to give it a 6, but it's a nice 6 just because I also think it doesn't 100% deliver on what it promises. And I do have to make sure that statement is not stricken from the record, because you call this the trial of the Incredible Hulk, and I'm going to put in a statute and threaten perjury, because this is ridiculous that they called it that. They should have trials, I would have been fine with, because that also would have been like a clever play on words, but all the cleverness is with Daredevil, and it's pretty well done. And I'm kind of disappointed we didn't get at least a pilot for that, but for reasons discussed, it wasn't meant to be. So it's a 6 for me, but I just, it is what it is. But that's not to say that I thought it was bad. Well, like all things, we are reaching the end of, well, certainly the Bill Bixby run of the Hulk, because we talked about this one having false advertising. You can't get more straightforward by calling it the death of the Incredible Hulk. Now, is that going to be literal or metaphorical? That remains to be seen. But Garrett, you know, you're the biggest fan of the three. And when you read the words, oh yeah, the death of the Hulk is coming, are you like, is excited the right word?
Yeah, I was excited. And the problem with this one is my dad was out of town. Him and my mom had actually gone to London the week that this movie was out. So I was watching it with somebody who had come to our house to watch their kids, me and my sister at that time. And yeah, I was really excited for it. I was excited to see how they would do it. Even I realized it's been on too long. It's time to leave with grace. Did they do that? We'll talk about that next week. But yeah, I was super excited for next week's film. But to give a little bit of context, I've only seen it once, and that was the one time it aired. I have not seen it since. So I remember hardly a thing about it except the final scene.
Adam?
Only because it ends these TV movies. I'm ready to move on. But also, when I was looking at all these, I'm like, I bet that one ends with him, quote unquote, killing off the Hulk, walking away. And then we see those eyes change, and then we get credit. Like, I think I can predict how this movie's going to end, because they're not killing off Bixby. There's no way.
Well, that's the problem I have with the comic medium in general, is no one stays dead. Even something like this, I'm expecting some kind of, if not literal, a definitive metaphorical death of the Hulk. I mean, it's kind of sad that they use that, and then Bill Bixby dies a year later. That's kind of bad timing.
Mm-hmm.
No, but you know what? The Joker died. The Joker ended up dying. So, you know, at that time, it was common to kill them all.
Well, it was common to kill the villains.
That's true.
But as far as, like, the heroes, I mean, when you think about major, like, hero deaths in comics, a lot of the big ones aren't until, you know, they killed Bucky in the 60s or whatever, but they took a long time to bring him back, and that one was actually a clever way to do it. But, I mean, how many times has Professor Xavier died, Adam, and they found a way to bring him back in the comics?
Think they do it twice a year anymore, which is the reason why I don't pull X-Men comics now.
Because, you know, it was also a little apropos, because we were pretty close to the death of Superman in comics.
Yeah.
Actually came out the same year, I think, because this is what, 92?
No, this is 90.
Okay, 1990. So a couple years before Superman would die in comics. Bullshit. But hey, that was a great marketing ploy, because that sold a lot of comics.
It sure did.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Will they actually deliver on a promise after shitting the bed in that aspect on this one? Well, we'll find out next week. So until we review the death of the Incredible Hulk, you wouldn't like me when I podcast.
That I'm dead. But they also think that this creature inside of me is a murderer, and they may someday be right. It's not human. Maybe it's what we were before we became human. Maybe it's the worst in us.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Do you really believe that I am separate from you?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
My mother always used to tell me getting angry doesn't help.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Mission Impossible film series, the Jaws franchise, the Lethal Weapon films, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, Avatar, and so much more.
I feel somehow we're alike.
I guess we could all learn something from the big goof.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I made a stink bomb once. Cleared out the whole school. What a wonderful fiasco. The whole school. My friends kept my secret, but forevermore they called me Stinky. Stinky!
Scheduling done by Matt.
Look at him. He lives for every second. To hell with tomorrow. Not a worry in the world. The worry he leaves to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What is it that you pound on my door with such insolence?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Security ought to be beefed up a lot more. In a place like this, you can't be too careful.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Are you ready?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Where will you go?
The city.
That's not a good place. People get lost in that city.
You have to stop someplace.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all sound clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
You take my secret with you, and I leave mine with you. I have a brother in the world now.
Yes, you do. My hand is in front.
I know.
You can leave us now.
And he tells him to find the apartment that Banner is staying at. Most iterations, he gets the name from his father's ring nickname.
See, this is why I love the fact that I'm doing these shows with you guys, because you mentioned what was the thing you compared it to? I'm sorry.
The skull shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the skull shirt in Punisher. You were
but this just made me laugh, and they literally, the climax of the that sun just fell off my shelf.
Oh shit.
But the climax of this movie,